From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I cannot tell you how important this money is. It is just sitting there. It is sitting there while jobs are being lost, while schools are being shut down, while seniors are losing services, while disabled people are being moved out of their homes and into nursing homes because there's no way to take care of them. This is unfolding around us, and it's within our power to at least help.
Stopgap spending plans do nothing to balance the budget. They don't grow jobs, they don't freeze property taxes, and they don't fix our broken system.
So it's wonderful that you want to come here and pretend that you have some plan and pretend that you have a backbone, but there is no one on that side of the aisle, no one on that side of the aisle in the last 2 years has shown the spine to stand up to your leader.
The path forward here is for a bipartisan negotiation, for us to work together on a comprehensive and balanced budget, and I just don't see hopping from one stopgap to the next as a way that we accomplish that.
It was very painful for even Democrats to watch the governor throw Christine Rodogno under the bus.
My name is J.B. Pritzker, and I'm running for governor of Illinois. Governor Rauner talks about what he might get done, or what he tried to get done. It's past time for all his talk. It's time for action. It's what I've been doing my whole life, taking action, and that's what I'll do as your governor.
Billionaire businessman J.B. Pritzker is running for governor as a Democrat, and House Democrats take another crack at pushing money out the door to support human services and higher education. We'll talk about that and more this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey in the Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau. Sean Crawford is away. Our panel, as ever, includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And our guest is Monique Garcia, State House Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune. Monique, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
So, Monique, let's start by talking about the stopgap budget. The Democrats are calling it a lifeline budget. What are they trying to do with this?
Well, this, again, is another temporary spending plan. As everyone knows, on January 1st, an old stopgap plan expired. That means universities, community colleges, social service programs are once again going without funding because of the continued budget impasse. Democrats in the House say that they had waited and tried to see what would happen in the Senate for that bipartisan plan that was being considered. That stalled, and they said, we're sick of waiting. They are looking specifically to tap into two particular pots of money that are set aside for higher ed and special and social service programs and say, you know, this is money that's just accumulating. We can't spend it anyway, so let's go ahead and put it out the door and put it back into the communities.
Yeah, and that's an important point, I think, that they make, that this is money that it was set aside from the income tax. The back when they passed the tax increase in 2011, they had these commitment to human services fund, commitment to education fund, I think they're called. And it's a tiny fraction of the income tax collection goes into those funds, and it's just been building up and building up. And they say the money is, you know, effectively collecting dust. But I gather Republicans are not on board with this stopgap spending plan.
No, they're not. And this is part of the governor's general opposition to one-off spending plans. Though he has agreed to some of them in the past when things have gotten particularly dire, he has tried to prevent these things. He says that this is adding to the deficit, which might not be entirely genuine. But he's also now trying to tie these things to his broader turnaround agenda, where he's saying, okay, fine, if this is all you're going to do to rush people money, then I will only sign it if it includes a permanent property tax freeze. Democrats say those things don't really go together. They contend that a permanent property tax freeze will actually hurt local communities, especially school districts who rely heavily on that money. And they just say that that's a disingenuous argument and that the governor is just trying to stand in the way of really any kind of progress on a budget.
Charlie, one of the arguments we heard from Republicans on this proposal is that it takes the pressure off, right? That this is a that the state government needs this pressure to be on in order to help foster an overall budget deal. What do you have any thoughts on that counter argument that they're making?
Yeah, my take on it would be, yeah, that's true. The pressure will be off, and you won't have situations like occurred a few weeks ago when a mom comes in and testifies before legislative committees that her toddler, who relies on oxygen to survive because the state hasn't paid the bills, the company that supplied the oxygen was going to take it away. The sheriff's deputy showed up at her door and heard her story and, to their credit, refused to withdraw her tanks. They finally found her another provider. Yeah, that's the kind of pressure that this might take off. It's been referred to as a stopgap, but in another sense, it's a lifeline in the sense that this money were made available to some of these local human service agencies. You could provide services without which there's a real chance that people are going to die. And it takes the pressure off from Rauner's drive to get property tax freezes, which the only way that they would work on the local level would be, particularly for school districts, would be if the state were suddenly to come up with a huge chunk of money to send out to local school districts to cover increasing costs, or, which I believe is Rauner's preference, if we were to tell local school districts, okay, you no longer have to deal with those pesky teachers' unions. You no longer have to bargain collectively about wages and healthcare benefits and other items in a contract, and that's how you're going to save the bucks. So it's kind of a cynical ploy, I think, using people's suffering to get your way on something that, if it were left to stand on its own merits and put to a vote of the General Assembly, would not go anywhere.
I'd also note, though, that Republicans have pushed ideas that have helped relieve some of the pressure. For instance, there's the pay lawsuit over whether or not state employees should get paid. Republicans and the governor are arguing that they should get paid, but Attorney General Madigan, who says that there isn't the authority to do that, contends that this is about her trying to put pressure on lawmakers and the governor to come together. So it really just kind of depends on the day or the week or the month when a particular side decides whether or not we need pressure or not to get something done. But it's been very clear that there have been pressure points, and those don't really spur a lot of action.
Go ahead, Charlie.
I was going to say the difference in my mind is that the suffering that occurs when you don't fund human services is acute, it's severe, it's life-threatening, but it's limited. Not everybody knows someone who relies on domestic violence shelters or someone who has an autistic child. For the folks who do, these services are critical. But for most of the general public, they don't really notice. On the other hand, if, for example, the Attorney General were successful in having the Supreme Court overturn the ruling from St. Clair County that has people being paid without an appropriation, a lot of people would notice in a big hurry. Or if the schools didn't open because there was no funding for K-12 education, everybody would notice. And the pressure would be great on the lawmakers and the governor to get something done. And probably what's needed to break this kind of impasse, the standoff between Rauner and legislative Democratic leadership, particularly House Speaker Michael Madigan, is for rank-and-file members to rise up and tell both of them on both sides of the aisle, look, you have this I got to think of a word that I can use. I can't say what I want to say. This standoff where you're trying to show who's got more testicular virility than the other, but our people back home are suffering. So we are demanding that you back off and find some kind of compromise. Maybe you guys should go arm wrestle somewhere that will allow our constituents to stop suffering.
Testicular virility, a throwback to the rhetoric of the Blagojevich era, if I remember correctly. Yep. You know, Representative Scott Drury, who has not been the most popular Democrat in the House, sort of made an impassioned speech in favor of this stopgap. He pointed out that he voted against a lot of these stopgaps in the past, and said that, you know, he knows what it feels like to stand up. He's the Democrat who was shunned and in some ways punished for not voting for Speaker Michael Madigan's re-election as Speaker of the House earlier this year. And he, you know, suggested exactly what you're saying, Charlie, that Republicans ought to stand up to their leader who is encouraging them not to go along with these things.
Right. Democrats are really painting this as a moral issue, that this is about people, as Charlie mentioned, who are suffering. And to be clear, the amount of money we're talking about here is not huge. I think the total amount is about $817 million. About $258 million would go to social service programs, and that is a fraction of what they normally would get. And this, you have to remember that this is a problem that has been compounding for the last 2 years. They didn't have their full budgets last year either. So a lot of this money, in many cases, will likely go to backfill payments that they didn't get. So they're trying to pay off debt, old bills, trying to pay off borrowing that they've had to do to try to keep their doors open during this budget impasse.
And meanwhile, we're hearing from domestic violence groups that say, and they were actually left out of the last stopgap, apparently because of an oversight, but they did not get any funding in that round. So some of them have scaled back services, laid off their staff. There's one in Southern Illinois that's threatening to close. There is ongoing fallout from this day after day. And as that's happening, Charlie, we get word from the sort of budget analysts that are employed by the legislature that Illinois is on pace to collect even less tax money than it thought it might this fiscal year.
Yeah, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which is the legislature's, what would you say, budget gurus, came out with a report just a few days ago that through the first three quarters of FY17, which is going to end on June 30th, the state had collected in its general fund $1.3 billion less than a year ago, and that's almost 6%. As a result, they've revised downward the revenue estimate for this year by almost $700 million, and they're now saying, looking ahead to FY18, which starts July 1st, we're only going to have growth of approximately the available revenues to spend of only like $31 billion. And the governor's proposed spending plan comes out to be around $37 billion. So what that means is that $700 million that we're not going to get in that we thought we would will wind up increasing the backlog of bills in the comptroller's office to something like $14 or $15 billion. And what that then means for the next fiscal year is that the first $14 billion or $15 billion of revenues that come in can't be spent on FY18 programs. They have to be spent to cover the outstanding bills from FY17. So it's just a vicious cycle, and it continues to perpetuate itself. And in the meantime, as I said before, and I do think it's a moral issue, people are suffering because of this political hubris.
Well, it's been 646 days now without a budget, and people that I've talked to say that they don't really expect, they hope that something can come about. They like to use that rhetoric of hope, but they will say privately and on the record that they don't really think that Illinois is going to get a budget deal before the next election. So let's turn our attention to the race for governor. This week, we heard from J.B. Pritzker, who announced that he is going to run in the Democratic primary. It's a growing list of candidates. Monique, who is J.B. Pritzker?
Well, J.B. Pritzker is the billionaire heir to the Hyatt Hotel fortune. He's long been involved in politics, helped fundraise for Hillary Clinton. So he really kind of is representing, to some, the divide right now that is in the Democratic Party between him and another announced candidate, Chris Kennedy. They're both very, very wealthy. On the other hand, we have two not as wealthy candidates, Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston and Chicago Alderman Amaya Pawar, who are saying that they're more about the people. And this is really kind of a reflection of the politics that we've seen at the national level, where you have, you know, the kind of moneyed established candidates versus the more outsider candidates, particularly Bernie Sanders. And so Democrats really are grappling with what kind of message they want to send. Do they want to get behind the people who have the money, who have the resources to take on somebody like Governor Rauner, who, as we all know, has already put millions and millions of his own money into his race? Or are they looking for those kind of more independent, progressive voices who perhaps have more mass appeal?
And you didn't mention Bob Diber, the regional superintendent of schools, who's also in the Democratic race for governor. Doesn't get as much attention, though. Charlie, what do you think? Is the Democratic primary going to be a David and Goliath story, or a Goliath and Goliath story? Or I should say, Goliath story in the general election campaign?
Yeah, it looks like now the primary could be Goliath, David. But you never know until filing actually occurs. And I guess the quandary for the Democrats is, you know that Bruce Rauner has already put $50 million into his campaign fund. For all practical purposes, his resources are unlimited. He and his colleagues, who are also in the same income bracket, have the money and they're willing to invest it to try and shape Illinois according to what they see as the way forward. And so the quandary for the Democrats is, do we want to have a candidate that can match them? And in the case of Pritzker, probably keep up with them, if not surpass them, but then undercuts the campaign message that these are rich guys trying to steal the state for their own benefit. Or do we go with somebody like Senator Biss, or the school superintendent Diber, or Alderman Pawar, who don't have that kind of money, but would be able to make a more populist pitch? So that's the ideal, I guess, would be if someone like Pritzker or Kennedy would be able to sell themselves as a populist, or if Biss, Pawar, Diber suddenly won, you know, the Mega Million lottery or whatever.
I would note that the two heavy hitters here, Pritzker and Kennedy, are trying to sell themselves as populists. Chris Kennedy specifically this week announced, when Pritzker announced that he's raised $1 million from several hundred, if not 1,000 or so, different independent donors. So he's trying to say that, look, it's not all about just my big money. I am taking this to the people. And J.B. Pritzker, on the other hand, is talking about tax plans where he says, yes, we should charge millionaires more. He's looking at that progressive income tax increase, maybe even a tax just on millionaires, and saying, hey, you know, we should pay more of our fair share, and the everyday man shouldn't have to be supporting government as much as they do.
And there's certainly a history in the Democratic Party of, you know, FDR was called a traitor to his class for his sort of working class pitch, despite his, you know, personal family wealth. And of course, we saw President Trump is a very wealthy man who was able to make a very populist appeal despite his wealth. And Governor Rauner, with his $18 watch and Carhartt jackets and motorcycle riding, certainly was able to come off as a populist. Monique,
but don't you think if the Democrats have someone who's in the same financial league as Rauner, that it does undercut the message about the rich guys being out of touch, despite how they phony themselves up as a common man? And wouldn't the Republican propaganda operation focus on, well, here's another rich guy?
It might. I'm not sure that the Republicans really can use that in this particular race because of who their flag bearer is, given that Governor Rauner's own vast personal wealth. And I think that the Democrats tried. So we had Barack Obama versus Mitt Romney sort of played that he's a rich guy out of touch card, and that worked in 2012. Pat Quinn tried to use that playbook in 2014, and he lost running against Governor Rauner. And I think that, you know, a lot of voters see a wealthy person and they think not, oh, that guy doesn't get me. They think, boy, I'd like to be like him someday. And there's that aspirational strain among American voters that makes them, you know, look up to wealthy people and not begrudge them their success. And so I'm not sure that's the particular fight we're going to see this time around. Although, of course, I think the politicians will use whatever weapon they have at hand.
And I wasn't saying that I agree with any of it. What I was saying, I was trying to figure out what are the people who get paid to cleverly craft lies to make them sound like almost true to be able to convince voters who are deluged with this competing information and don't have the time to sit down and spend hours and hours analyzing all of this stuff.
Well, Monique, we got a taste of what that message is going to be this week from the Republican Party in their attacks on Pritzker. Even before he had announced his campaign, they were saying, this is Madigan's guy. He wants to raise your taxes. I mean, we kind of see what they'd like to start their attacks, at least.
Right. I think it's going to be a continuation of, as always, linking every Democrat to Mike Madigan. I would note, though, that I think Democrats believe that they have a better argument this time around and that they can point to the last 2 years, 3 years by the time election comes around, under Rauner and saying that this has been complete dysfunction. And look, we have a guy in the office who isn't doing the job. So maybe it's not as much about who has the money and who doesn't, as much as who they ultimately think can change something and move the state forward, or at least move the state at all at this point. And we haven't seen any action. There hasn't been a whole lot of successes for Governor Rauner to point to, which is why he continues to put the focus and the pressure on Democrats and spend his money continuing to brand Mike Madigan and everyone who's ever talked to him as a boogeyman.
And maybe the message for the Democrats should simply be, is Illinois better off after 3.5 years of Rauner? Are you better off after 3.5 years of Rauner?
Charlie, can the governor, I mean, we've already had a taste. It's actually not his campaign, but some outside group has him starring in television ads where he's wearing a flannel shirt and he's in a very neat workshop. I would like whoever designed that workshop to come clean up my home workshop. And, you know, he's pulling duct tape off the camera lens to say that, you know, we don't need duct tape solutions in Illinois. It seems like he's still trying to run as an outsider, even though he has now been a politician for, 4 years, and he's been governor for 2 years. Is that something that he can still successfully position himself to do, Charlie?
I wouldn't think so. At some point, you have to be able to tell people, here's what I've accomplished. And if you look at it, the grand scheme of things, in terms of the state's finances, he's been the worst governor in history. He's the first guy in almost 200 years who wasn't able to get a budget in any of his first 2 years. And, I mean, that's not a very good record to run on. So, yeah, you have to kind of pretend that you're still out there, you're on the outside, so fighting the machine and fighting all these corrupt politicians, when, in fact, you're very much an insider. And you've built your own machine in the Republican Party.
You're listening to State Week. Our panel is Charlie Wheeler and Monique Garcia of the Chicago Tribune. I'm Brian Mackey. Monique, this week we saw the Senate pass a anti-firearm violator bill that the Chicago police and Chicago politicians have been asking for a year and arguably for several years now. There have been a number of versions of this. Can you talk a little bit about, how that got through the Senate finally?
Sure. Well, in essence, what the bill does is allow judges to impose stricter sentences for people who are repeat offenders who use a gun. This could be people who've used a gun previously or folks who've committed crimes, violent crimes that did not use a firearm but are this second time. And the argument here is that we need to go after the people who are really behind this kind of surge in street violence that we've seen in Chicago. And so initially, the plan seemed to have some momentum about a month or so ago. Superintendent Eddie Johnson with the Chicago Police Department came down and testified in favor. But it stalled because it also incorporated several changes to the criminal code that would, in the essence, lessen penalties on major drug offenders. The argument at the time was, okay, if we're going to try to lock more people up for guns, we should let some people go for drugs, which some people view as a lesser offense. But that ran into opposition from Republicans. Also, even the police who testified in favor of the bill said, we don't really like that part. So portions of that, the drug changes were stripped from the bill. The governor's office claimed that they had worked pretty closely with sponsoring Senator Kwame Raoul on that. And it did. It won support in the Senate. I'd note, however, that there was still opposition, particularly from the Black caucus, who viewed this as a way to lock up more Black and brown men. They said that it doesn't really go after the people who are selling guns, particularly in Indiana, and them coming over the border into Illinois. And it doesn't do anything to invest in communities that really need job training and drug treatment programs that fuel a lot of this violence.
Yeah, and I talked to a lot of criminal justice reform types who were scratching their heads a little bit because some of these ideas were arguably even watered down from what the governor's own criminal justice reform commission had proposed. And it leaves them wondering if, the governor really is going to be as powerful an advocate for criminal justice reform as he's been in the past, given that we are approaching an election year and these things can always be politically tricky. And President Trump has changed the tone on criminal justice with his, American Carnage commentary and his focus on violence in Chicago.
Right. Republicans have always been kind of, law and order candidates, and it's hard for some of them to go home and ask for re-election and then get hit by opponents who said that they've eased penalties on drug crimes, particularly for suburban Republicans where heroin right now is a major concern. And so it's yet to be seen if the governor's really going to kind of push for some of these things that he wanted. I mean, the whole point of this initially was to lower the prison population, which for Republicans is a money issue. But when you come down to the tough votes, they're not always there.
Time now for notes from the field. We've got a fairly luxurious, about 20 seconds each. Charlie, I'll begin with you.
Okay, well, talking about finances, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability also released a report talking about the state employees group insurance plan, and it pointed out that as of March 31st, the state owed providers and individuals who had to pay up front for services $4.4 billion, and the delays were ranging, depending on what type of a plan, what type of provider, were ranging from 3 months to more than 2 years, and the interest tab was over $400 million because we pay interest at between 9% and 12%, depending on the situation.
Monique Garcia.
While the governor and the speaker are fighting over whether or not to sell the Thompson Center in Chicago, one historical preservation group is fighting to save the building, saying you can sell it, but please don't knock it down.
I like the building. I know you work there and we're not a big fan of the...
I was not a big fan of it. So, I mean, it's beautiful from an outside architecture standpoint. It's all glass and there's that big atrium, but it's disgusting. There are cockroaches on the walls, the toilets overflow, and there were bed bugs.
Okay, on that note, 17 Illinois school districts have filed a lawsuit this week saying the state has not adequately funded public education. This is not the first time we've seen schools take this approach to trying to force more money out of state government, and we will be talking about that more in the weeks ahead. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Monique Garcia of the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.